Hello, and happy Memorial Day. Welcome to today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for this Monday, Memorial Day, May 25th, 2020. I'm your reader, Ralph Skippers. And looking at today's front page, we see headlines, letters, piece together Dubuquer's World War II connection, landfill sees surge in garbage, and successful mixed-to-go cocktails. On this Memorial Day, I believe we'll start with letters pieced together, Dubuquer's World War II connection. Woman finds late mother's correspondence with Technical Sergeant Donald Platt, by Bennett Goldstein. Since her mama's life was struck short by a drunken driver, Sandy Judas has always been searching for her. Sandy was just 11 when her mother died, and she has spent the ensuing years patching the decades-long gaps of memories with the nuggets of history she unearthed. I didn't really know who she was, Sandy said. Now 73 and retired after working for many years as an executive secretary and flight attendant, Sandy lives in Spring, Texas. Following her father's death in the late 1980s, she discovered while sorting through boxes in the family attic a cache of letters written by American World War II service members. They were addressed to her mother, Lily Martin. Jackpot, absolute jackpot, Sandy thought. These were things my mama touched. The text was not written by her mother's hand, but by listening in on half the conversation, Sandy could reconstruct the funny, smart woman she so missed. Perhaps, she considered, the descendants of these men possessed her mother's letters. Anything that was hers, I wanted them. Hello, Lily. Lily grew up poor in the agricultural outskirts of Lexington, Texas. To make money, she stalked wild turkeys in hopes of locating their nest, whereupon she hatched the chicks and sold them. During the war, she viewed it as her patriotic duty to support the troops, so she wrote reams of letters to soldiers both at home and overseas. She loved them soldier boys, Sandy said. Anyone who wrote to her, she would write back. Sandy counted at least 40 men, but Lily had a few favorites. One was from Dubuque, Technical Sergeant Donald Platt with the U.S. Army. Born in April 1915 in Rickardsville, Iowa, Donald was raised in a two-story home along Central Avenue in Dubuque. He worked construction before joining the military in 1942. In November, while stationed at Camp Barkley, a U.S. training installation in Texas, Donald's friend, Johnny, was showing off photographs of his gal friends with whom he corresponded. Donald spotted a photograph of a pixie-faced gal with flowing brown hair and a knowing stare. He had to get her address so he could write. Hello, Lily. This is probably going to surprise you, but I happen to be a pretty good friend of Johnny Phila, Donald said. I think you are awful cute. He asked her for a picture and provided one of himself. You will probably just ignore this, Donald speculated, later adding, I would like very much to meet you. Lily and Donald began a nearly two-year correspondence, burning through sheets of paper in curly longhand, regaling one another with goings-on of wartime America. Beer, and the lack of it, was a frequent subject. So, too, were their love lives, for both pen pals were unmarried. Donald, both flirty and bashful, speculated about Lily's prospects. Now wait a minute, Lily. Don't give me that line, Donald said. Having no boyfriends to talk about, I'll bet you have more than anyone there. That's right, now isn't it? You know it's a sin to tell a lie. He conveyed mock indignation when Lily suggested that he lusted after enlistees of the Women's Army Corps, brothers in arm. Donald served with the 359th Infantry Regiment, 90th Infantry Division, which crossed the pond and landed in England in April 1944. On D-Day, June 6th, part of his division landed on the Utah beach, followed days later by the remainder of the unit. Donald wrote Lily from the front lines. Lord, I was a sick little boy coming across here to France. However, I soon forgot all about that as it was pretty hot on shore, he said. No, Lily, there is no beer. No beautiful women. In other words, just nothing on the battlefield. She replied a month later. How is my foxhole man tonight? Lily asked. She reminded Donald that she could recall the name of his hometown and his age when they first started to correspond. She even knew his weight. "I've just decided to call you my adopted brother. You will be, won't you?" Lily asked. "Shoot a German for me, and I'll buy you a few extra bonds to send you more ammunition. Is that a deal?" Lily's letter was returned, unopened. On the envelope was scrawled, "Deceased. Burial." The military records that might shed light on the circumstances of Donald's death were destroyed or lost, so survivors only can speculate about what became of him after the American invasion of Nazi-occupied Europe. After landing in Normandy, his division traveled southwest through the French countryside. Soldiers moved to clear the Forêt de Montcastor, suffering thousands of casualties. Some were wounded, some captured, and some killed. Donald died July 6, 1944, at the age of 29. He was buried in a temporary American cemetery near Blossville. 4 years later, his body was disinterred and returned to Dubuque. A funeral was held at Holy Ghost Church, where Donald received last rites. He was laid to rest next to his grandmother at Mount Calvary Cemetery. Sandy believes the loss devastated Lily. Word spread around her small town to the point that a local newspaper caught wind and published a story. Lily moved to Houston the following year, where she married a Navy sailor and Sandy's father, Lawrence Havens. In 1958, while the family was returning home to Houston from a family reunion, a drunken driver broadsided Lawrence's car on the passenger side. Everyone was injured, Lily, 35, fatally. "I loved my mama," Sandy said. "I wanted to be everywhere she was all the time. I would tell them at school that I was sick, so she would have to come and get me." Connecting. Years later, across the country, another woman began to mine her family tree for stories. Karen Woolley, of Bangor, Maine, had always known her great-uncle Donald died in the war, but little else. She began to assemble a Platt family tree and posted it to a genealogy website. In 2016, Karen opened a message on her computer, which had been sent 2 years prior but went unnoticed. It was from Sandy. Was Karen related to Donald Platt? Had she heard of a Texas gal named Lily? Sandy sent the letters to their real home. "Nobody in the family knew that they were writing letters to each other," Karen said. "It was like getting to know somebody that was a family member that we never had. Hope." Sandy has returned letters to the families of four men with whom Lily corresponded, but none possess any from her mother. As far as Donald's, Sandy made copies, which she had read more than once. "I loved Donald," she said. "He would add positive things to your life if you knew him. I know he did to mine and to Mama's." His writing also brought immeasurable joy to Karen's family, including her mother, who died Thursday. Now, the letters are the family's last physical connection to the man. "Things happen that you can't explain," Karen said. "I think we have some assistance from people that are on the other side." Donald and Lily never did meet. Neither have Karen and Sandy. But the letters that bind them have kindled their faith. "Everybody is connected in some way," Karen said. "I guess it's also a reminder. There is always hope." In the week before his death, Donald drafted his final letter to Lily from the French battlefield. It wasn't much, and he apologized for the shabby paper on which his tidy cursive was scribbled. "I will write whenever I can, but I am sure you realize that may not be too often," he said. "For, after all, there is the matter of a German army to contend with. So now, Blue Eyes, for now, I will sign off. Be sure and write real soon. And how about that snapshot?" Next on the front page, successful mix, to-go cocktails. Dubuque Mining Company meets demand for drinks. Maquoketa business aids wedding. Local dessert shop finds online success. By Jeff Montgomery. BizBuzz shares business tidbits from around the tri-states each Monday. This week, we highlight developments in Dubuque and Maquoketa, Iowa. For years, customers at Dubuque Mining Company grew accustomed to enjoying its mixed drinks inside the restaurant. The COVID-19 pandemic and the flurry of rule changes that followed have allowed bars throughout Iowa to serve alcoholic cocktails on a to-go basis temporarily. Dubuque Mining Company announced on April 1st that it would offer its famous mixed drinks for carryout and curbside pickup. "It was really big to start out with," owner Guy Parkin recalled. At that time, People hadn't had one for a couple weekends, so there was a lot of demand. The first couple weekends were just crazy. Parkin said customers collectively ordered 350 mixed drinks on a to-go basis the first Saturday after such purchases became legal. He recalled many customers saying they were excited to go home and sit out on their deck while they enjoyed the beverages. But Parkin said he doesn't expect the craze to last, noting that the proclamation allowing carry-out mixed drinks is slated to expire Wednesday, May 27th. Bars and other establishments serving alcohol can reopen indoor spaces on Thursday, May 28th, albeit with limited capacity. Parkin thinks it is highly likely that the to-go cocktail concept will be nixed by state officials as bars resume more traditional sales practices. "I have mixed feelings about it," he said. "This rule helped us get through everything, and some people will be upset they can't do it anymore. But we are happy to see things getting back to normal around here." Restaurants in Dubuque County were allowed to reopen to dine-in customers on May 15th, but Dubuque Mining Company didn't immediately seize that opportunity. Parkin said he plans to reopen the restaurant's doors at some point this week. Dubuque Mining Company is located at 555 John F. Kennedy Road and can be reached at 563-557-1729. Small Business Aids Wedding. A longtime Maquoketa business played a key role in an impromptu wedding earlier this month. Melissa Ray, owner of Max Ray Jeweler in Maquoketa, agreed to stay open late on the afternoon of May 9th, allowing a local bride-to-be to purchase a ring for her fiancé just hours before they exchanged vows. Ray said she was happy to play a role in the wedding. "Of course, I was willing to stay open late for them," Ray said. The last-minute ring purchase was essential for the wedding of Courtney Keller and her now husband, Nolan of Maquoketa. Courtney and Nolan were slated to tie the knot in front of about 100 guests on May 9th, but opted to postpone the wedding due to the pandemic. "When that day came around, I was kind of upset," Courtney recalled. "I had looked forward to that being our wedding day." Much to Courtney's surprise, a group of close friends, with the help of Nolan, surprised her by crafting a plan to proceed with the wedding after all. Courtney and Nolan were married at a friend's house in Maquoketa, with a small group of close friends and family in attendance. Courtney's father served as the officiant. But they emphasized the impromptu wedding would have been impossible without Nolan's ring and the help of a local business. Max Ray Jeweler, 134 South Main Street, was founded more than 75 years ago by Ray's grandfather. Ray said she was happy to lend a helping hand for a local wedding. And Courtney is pleased that a local business helped make her wedding day a reality. "I work at a small business, and I shop at small businesses," she said. "For me, to support a small business, especially these days, was really important." Candle Ready Cakes finds silver lining. The owner of a downtown Dubuque dessert business has found a way to grow sales in the midst of the pandemic. Jill Tolosky and Candle Ready Cakes recently established an online ordering system for popular products such as cakes and cupcakes. She also began offering virtual cake classes that allowed her to spread her baking wisdom to customers. Tolosky said the new offerings were born of necessity. The spread of COVID-19 forced Candle Ready Cakes to close to walk-in customers for about 2 months. It also led to the postponement of weddings, which have long served as a key source of revenue for the business. Tolosky was amazed by the success of the online orders, which was a new offering for the business. Customers can pick up their items at the store, 197 Main Street, during the morning or elect to have them delivered in the afternoon. Meanwhile, Candle Ready Cakes started selling baking kits to customers who can use these ingredients to bake their own items while following along with a video tutorial offered by Tolosky. The new offerings have helped Tolosky achieve an uptick in sales at a time when most businesses are struggling to stay afloat. "As disappointing as this whole situation has been, it's definitely pushed us to come up with new ways of doing things," she said. "It's pushed us out of our comfort zone in ways that will continue to help us in the future." Candle Ready Cakes reopened to walk-in customers on Tuesday. The store is open from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., Tuesday through Friday, and 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Saturday. And the final article from the front page, landfill sees surge in garbage. During pandemic restrictions, many people are clearing homes and starting projects producing more trash, by John Cruz. Trash is piling up faster than usual at the tri-state area's local landfill and solid waste disposal facilities. In the past few months, officials have seen increases in residential waste being disposed of. Fred Freiberg, director of the Waste Authority of Jackson County, said the Jackson County Transfer Station is seeing record amounts of trash enter his facility every day. "We are at the absolute max that we can handle," Freiberg said. "It's been going on for months now." At the Dubuque Metropolitan Area Solid Waste Agency, residential trash disposal has increased by 8.6% compared to last year, and the facility is overloaded with people driving to the landfill looking to drop off their garbage. "We've had 30 vehicle lines," said Ken Miller, Solid Waste Agency Administrator. "People had to wait to get in." Landfill officials attribute the influx of trash to the lockdown produced by the pandemic. With many people stuck at home, large-scale projects and spring cleanups have been on the rise, and with that has come the sizable quantities of waste that such endeavors produce. "Everyone is off work, and they are cleaning out their homes or doing some project," Freiberg said. "You typically see a surge of spring cleaning around now, but this is more than we are used to." In the first 3 months of the year, Freiberg said the transfer station received an additional 200 tons over what was originally projected. He expects April, May, and June to be even higher. He estimates that a vehicle comes to the transfer station to drop off trash on average every 2 minutes. Processing the swaths of trash is made more difficult by the extra safety measures solid waste disposal staff are taking to reduce potential exposure to COVID-19. Electronic and tire processing has been reduced. Offices have been closed, and disinfectant is being used constantly. All of these actions have made processing the large amounts of trash more challenging. "Employee safety is the number one focus," Freiberg said. "It's challenging because moving garbage out is a public health necessity, so we have to keep working hard on moving it." Miller said lines are getting longer in part because of the extra precautions workers need to take when collecting trash. "Every person we stop on the scale takes a little longer," Miller said. "It usually involves us asking more questions." While residential waste disposal has increased, Miller said the impact to the landfill has been offset by decreases in solid waste coming from businesses and commercial sources. Scott Dittmer, owner of Dittmer Recycling, said recycled products have seen a similar shift. "Bottles and cans have been on the rise since the pandemic hit the area, while paper and cardboard have been on the decline. It just kind of shifted," Dittmer said. "There's been less of this and more of that." Despite the challenges, Freiberg said he believes the Jackson County Transfer Station should be able to weather the storm. All of the pandemic home projects will eventually need to come to an end. "Hopefully, everyone will finish up soon," Freiberg said. "This sort of thing can't go on forever." From the Dubuque and Tri-State page, 10 new COVID-19 cases in Dubuque County. Area southwestern Wisconsin counties report 6 new cases and 1 new death. 10 additional cases of COVID-19 in Dubuque County were confirmed between 6 a.m. Saturday and 5 p.m. Sunday, bringing the county's total to 319 confirmed cases. The county death toll remains at 16, while 146 people in the county diagnosed with the coronavirus have recovered. No new cases or deaths were reported in Clayton, Delaware, Jackson, and Jones counties between 6 a.m. Saturday and 5 p.m. Sunday. Clayton County has 30 cases with 3 deaths. Delaware County has 14 cases and no deaths. Jackson County has 11 cases and no deaths. And Jones County has 36 cases and no deaths. Statewide, there were 456 additional confirmed cases for a total 17,251 positive cases as of 5 p.m. Sunday. The state reported 11 more deaths since Saturday morning, for a total of 455. Statewide, 9,324 Iowans have recovered, and as of Friday, 362 Iowans were hospitalized due to COVID-19, including 10 Dubuque County residents. The state's confirmed case count for Dubuque specialty care increased by 2 from Saturday to reflect the 49 cases that the facility's parent company reported as of Monday. 10 individuals at the long-term care facility have recovered, according to state data. In Wisconsin, there are 400 new cases and 3 new deaths reported Sunday, pushing the total of confirmed cases to 15,277. The total number of hospitalizations was 2,315, an increase of 23 from Saturday's report. The number of deaths related to the coronavirus in Wisconsin is 510. 6 new cases and 1 new death was reported in area southwestern Wisconsin counties since early Saturday. Grant County recorded 1 new death and 1 new case for a total of 82 cases and 11 deaths. Lafayette County recorded 3 more cases for 21 total and no deaths. Crawford County has recorded 1 more case for 26 total cases and no reported deaths. Iowa County had 1 more case for 12 total cases and no deaths. In Illinois, the state reported an additional 2,508 cases, along with 66 more related deaths. The state totals now stand at 110,304 cases and 4,856 deaths. Joe Davies County reported no change from Saturday, with a total of 26 cases. Nationally, there have been more than 1.6 million positive COVID-19 cases and more than 97,900 confirmed coronavirus deaths. Next, hundreds of stir-crazy families flocked to reopened Dubuque River Museum. Masked employees welcome visitors after 2 months of being closed due to COVID-19 pandemic, by Thomas J. Barton. This article is accompanied by a picture of Casey Greer Jr., 3, of Verndale, Minnesota, as he steers a toy boat at the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque on Sunday. Once through the sliding doors, 2-year-old Alana Mangus and sister Maria, 6, quickly beelined for the open-air habitat of waterfowl, turtles, and fish. The two pressed their faces and palms against the glass to get a good look at eye level of the fish swimming in the tank. For children, it's been difficult to find activities to keep them occupied and entertained, with schools, playgrounds, and other places closed due to the ongoing pandemic, their mother Abby Mangus of Marion, Iowa, said on Sunday. "They've been going stir-crazy," Mangus said. "It's just been difficult. So coming here means a lot because they can actually learn about what's out here and actually get outside and enjoy nature." The National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium reopened this weekend after 2 months of being closed due to COVID-19. Masked employees welcomed hundreds of visitors eager to get out of the house for the Memorial Day weekend. Kristen Leffler, volunteer and intern coordinator at the River Museum, on Sunday said the museum saw about 400 people per day, Friday and Saturday. "I think it's safe to say all of us, animals included, have really, really missed the vibrancy around here that our community brings when they come to visit," Leffler said. Staff, she said, used the time during the lockdown to clean and make repairs and upgrades to the museum. That included the opening of a new 3,000-square-foot exhibit that features a working 19th-century belt-driven machine shop that once created motors for racing boats on the Mississippi River. "There's been really wonderful virtual experiences offered," Leffler said. "But I think a lot of people are really happy to see things in person, even if it's a little bit different than what they're used to." Jenny Beck, 15, of Roscoe, Illinois, said it was nice to get out of the house and see animals for once that weren't her 2 cats. The aquarium's river otters are the family's favorite. Family members used the holiday weekend for what they said was a much-needed 2-day getaway to Dubuque. "Just needed a refresher from all of the staying at home," Marlene Beck said. "Since it reopened, we thought it would be a good opportunity to come out and do something fun for a change." The River Museum has capped attendance at 75 people every half hour to ease congestion and facilitate social distancing, so they feel safe and comfortable here, Loeffler said. The museum has also implemented a timed ticketing system and asks guests to purchase tickets in advance on its website. Guests are only allowed to enter the museum campus through the paddle wheel building, with floor signs directing people through the museum. All museum staff will be required to wear masks, and guests are strongly encouraged to wear their own during their visit. People have been really respectful so far of the rules and things we've put in place, such as distancing, Loeffler said. Western Dubuque graduate receives Fulbright Award by Elizabeth Kelsey. A 2016 graduate of Western Dubuque High School, Julia Wickham has always been fascinated by history, politics, and the stories that bring them to life. With an elected official for a father, Dubuque County Supervisor Jay Wickham, and a history teacher for a grandfather, Tom Wickham, perhaps it was inevitable. She even has an uncle, also named Tom Wickham, who is the parliamentarian for the U.S. House of Representatives. My grandpa was big into history, Wickham said. When I was younger, he would dress up as Abraham Lincoln and recite the Gettysburg Address. Politics have always been in my family. At the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, Wickham majored in history and political science. A spring 2019 study abroad trip to South Africa and Namibia allowed her to put her passions into action while conducting political research. The program was experiential learning, so I never sat in a classroom, Wickham said. All of our work was done with educators and organizers in the communities we were visiting. I loved talking to people and asking questions as a way to learn, so I loved hearing their stories. Her experience led her to pursue and earn a Fulbright U.S. Student Program Award in Study Research to Namibia for the 2020-21 academic year. 2 weeks after I came back to the U.S., I was applying to Fulbright because I knew I wanted to go back to Namibia, she said. The Fulbright U.S. Student Program offers fellowships for U.S. students to study, teach, and conduct research in more than 160 countries. This year, Wickham is one of more than 2,100 U.S. citizens selected. Dr. Tom Lynch, assistant professor of political science at St. Thomas, served as Wickham's advisor during the application process. This was Lynch's first time advising a Fulbright applicant, but he praised the support that the university offers applicants as well as Wickham's determination. What we do at St. Thomas is a real team effort, but all of this is about Julia, he said. It is her unique abilities that have made this happen for her. It's her ability to combine her experience with the skills that she learned through her majors in a meaningful way to investigate a topic that's of great importance. During her 10-month experience, Wickham will work with a professor at the University of Namibia to research political participation among Namibian youth. Although the trip was scheduled to begin in August 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic has pushed back that date until at least January 2021. Social distancing will also change Wickham's in-person, group-based research methods, but she hopes to use social media to adapt. Just because you can't see people engaging in politics doesn't mean they're not there, she said. After returning from Namibia, Wickham plans to pursue a career in public interest law. I think doing study abroad is a really great experience, but this is going to take things to the next level, Lynch said. It's just going to provide a real opportunity for her to stretch and grow. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Monday, May 25th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Joyce E. Peach Cartmill, 88, of Dubuque, formerly of Fair Play, Wisconsin, passed away on Friday evening, May 22nd, at home with family by her side. Private funeral and burial services will be on Thursday, May 27th, at St. John's Lutheran Cemetery in Dubuque. A public visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, May 27th, at the Miller Funeral Home in East Dubuque. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the strict guidelines of the CDC and state will be followed, and only 10 people will be permitted in the funeral home at any one time. Joyce was born on March 17, 1932, in Dubuque, the daughter of Robert and Ella L. Thompson Waller. She was united in marriage to James Lee Cartmill on June 24, 1955, in Dubuque. He preceded her in death on December 25, 1996. Joyce was a graduate of Dubuque Senior High School. She was previously employed at Wallace, Kunert, Price, and Smith Insurance, and later at the Findlay Hospital, from where she retired. Life consisted not only of working, but also having a good time. She enjoyed traveling, especially her bus trips to see the Cubs. She was a member of UAW Local 94 Auxiliary and treasured playing cards with her friends. You could never go wrong when buying her a Precious Moments or anything to do with Cardinals, as you could see these displayed throughout her home. Joyce appreciated time with her family and regularly felt compelled to tell her children the truth, even if it wasn't what they wanted to hear. During Christmas and birthdays, she loved to spoil her grandchildren, which they didn't mind at all. She may have lacked patience with her husband at times, as James could be difficult, but this seemed to keep the marriage lively. Joyce had a real knack for housekeeping in her own special way. Her family will miss the organized chaos that could lead into a treasure hunt during any given visit. The family would like to acknowledge Joyce's friends and fellow co-workers at the Findlay Hospital for the kindness shown to their mother and grandmother. A very special thanks to Mike Sandy Neenan of Fairplay, Wisconsin, for being a considerate, caring neighbor to Joyce for many years. A Joyce E. Peach Cartmill Memorial Fund has been established, and memorials may be mailed to Miller Funeral Home, 1185 Route 35 North, East Dubuque, Illinois. Attention, Joyce Cartmill family. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.millerfhed.com. Mark J. Mink LaHaye, 95, of Epworth, Iowa, passed away peacefully in his sleep on Sunday, May 24th, at Oak Park Place in Dubuque, Iowa. While his family is sad, the pesky gophers of Dubuque County are breathing a sigh of relief. Because of the unprecedented conditions in our country right now, a traditional funeral mass will not be held at this time. A private family visitation will be held for Mark on Tuesday, May 26th. Public burial with social distancing etiquette in place will be held at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, May 26th at St. Patrick's Cemetery in Epworth, Iowa. Friends and family may send memorials to the Reef Funeral Home. Attention, Mark LaHaye family, P.O. Box 99, Farley, Iowa, 52046. Mark was born on January 10, 1925, in Graff, Iowa, son of Richard R. and Sophie C. Breitbach LaHaye. He received his education from St. Clemens High School in Bankston, Iowa. He was a veteran, having served in the United States Army Air Corps during World War II and the United States Air Force during the Korean War. On June 10, 1950, he was united in marriage to Teresa Steffens at St. Clemens Catholic Church in Bankston, Iowa. She preceded him in death on April 20, 1995. Mark worked at John Deere Dubuque Works until he retired in 1985. During his 35 years of retirement, he spent countless hours walking the trails, enjoying nature, and serving as a community predator control specialist. He was a member of St. Patrick's Parish in Epworth, Iowa. Mark was also a member of the Epworth American Legion John White Post No. 650 and a retired member of the Epworth Fire Department. The family would like to give a special thanks to the staff at Oak Park Place and Hospice of Dubuque for their kindness and care. To honor Mark's life, take some time to respect and care for God's creation. If you would like to view video tribute or send online condolences to the family, please visit our website at www.reeffuneralhomeinc.com. Kathleen F. Kathy Heim, 67, of Dubuque, died May 21st. To honor Kathy, a celebration of life will be held at Steeple Square at a later date. Online condolences may be left at www.reeffuneralhomeinc.com. tristatecremationcenter.com. Clarence Junie J. Wallenhorst, 80, of Hazel Green, Wisconsin, passed away on Saturday, May 23rd, at home. Due to this unknown time of COVID-19, a private family service will be held at St. Francis de Sales Catholic Church in Hazel Green, Wisconsin, with Father Kenneth Frisch officiating. Burial with military honors will be in the St. Joseph's Church Cemetery in Sinsinawa, Wisconsin. The Hodenshield Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Cuba City, Wisconsin, is serving the family. In lieu of plants and flowers, a Clarence J. Wallenhorst Memorial Fund has been established. Memorials may be mailed to the Hodenshield Funeral Home, care of Clarence Wallenhorst Family, Box 825, Cuba City, Wisconsin, 53807. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.hodenshieldfuneralhome.com. Kim Eisler, 80, of Rockford, Illinois, formerly of Dubuque, died May 23rd. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. Wednesday, May 27th, at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service, 3860 Asbury Road. The funeral service for Kim will be at 12 p.m. Wednesday, May 27th, at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery in Dubuque. Condolences and virtual hugs can be sent to the family by visiting Kim's obituary at www.hskfhcares.com. Betty Hardiman, 84, of Darlington, Wisconsin, died May 23rd. A private family funeral service will be held Tuesday, May 26th at 1 p.m. at the Erickson Funeral Home in Argyle, Wisconsin, at 801 East Milwaukee Street, with Reverend Angela Utter officiating. Burial will be in Fayette Methodist Cemetery in rural Darlington. Marilyn M. Grattan, 80, of Cassville, Wisconsin, died May 23rd. In keeping with Marilyn's wishes, there will be a private family burial at the Cassville Cemetery, Cassville, at a later date. Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory in Lancaster is assisting the family. Robert Bob McKenna, 90, of Gratiot, Wisconsin, died May 21st. A private mass of Christian burial will be held at St. Joseph's Catholic Church, 5685 Main Street, Gratiot, with Reverend Sudhakar Devarapu officiating. Burial will be in St. Joseph's Cemetery in Gratiot, Wisconsin. Next, from the sports page, eligibility question not easy for D3 athletes. Is it worth it for seniors to come back for another year? By Brandon West. Tyler Carlson could have graduated last December. Baseball called him back. An aviation flight operations major at the University of Dubuque, Carlson decided one last season of college baseball was worth holding out for one extra semester. His senior year was off to a fairly solid start, too. 9 games into the Spartan season, Carlson started 2 games, notched a win, and was tied for the team lead with 12 strikeouts. On March 13th, he came on in relief for 2 innings, allowing just 1 base runner with 3 strikeouts in UD's 1-0 win over Concordia Chicago during the Spartans' Florida trip. Carlson even held off on finishing his flight training so he could attend. He didn't know it at the time, but that was the last game of Carlson's college career. The NCAA canceled spring sports shortly thereafter in light of the coronavirus outbreak. Baseball's been my whole life. I was so fortunate to be able to play at UD and enjoy my time, said Carlson, a Crystal Lake, Illinois native. I'm ready now for the next part of my life. The NCAA has amended its rules to grant an extra year of eligibility to spring athletes who were impacted by the season's cancellation, but the decision of whether or not to use that extra year isn't as easy as it might seem, especially for Division III senior athletes who don't receive athletic scholarships. Carlson thought long and hard about whether or not he wanted to come back for a second senior year. For a number of reasons, it's just not practical to come back, his love of the game notwithstanding. That's the way it is for a number of athletes in his position. Everybody saw the news that the NCAA is going to be really nice and grant us that extra year, Carlson said. But the thing is, they're not footing the bill for that extra schoolwork you have to do. You're not getting reimbursements to cover that last year. It seemed like they were extending eligibility for a fifth year, but the only way you could take advantage of that was if you were not graduating or pursuing grad school. It kind of defeats the purpose. Who's not ready to graduate by their senior year? Carlson said one stipulation athletes must meet is that they have to earn enough credits in both the fall and spring semesters to meet eligibility criteria. Unless Carlson wanted to pursue his master's, at this time he doesn't, his hands were essentially tied. It's still not an easy decision for athletes who already planned on grad school. Morgan Jekyll, a senior infield for the UD softball team, will be back on campus next season, but she won't be suiting up for the Spartans because as she works towards a master's in education, she doesn't believe she'll have the time to fit in softball. It's a big decision for anyone in my position, said Jekyll, a Scales Mound, Illinois native. My other teammates that were seniors waited as well. A lot of us had our plans set up for next year. For us to change it because of softball, for me, I was already thinking about my softball time being done. There's definitely a lot of back and forth. Are we going to take that opportunity or just move on? It's definitely a huge mind game. You're weighing if you're going to benefit. Are you going to be happy? Local D3 coaches have tried to walk their athletes through this unprecedented scenario. Laura's softball coach, Ashley Winter, said all three of her seniors decided they won't take up the extra year. They have plans, and they already made those plans, Winter said. I know the athletes that didn't get to compete really appreciated the NCAA's eligibility extension. It's going to be interesting to see what the ripple effect of this will be for years to come. Extra eligibility has forced some athletes to consider options they hadn't before, though. Jordan Nelson, another pitcher for UD Baseball, said he was set on graduating this spring before the shutdown of sports. Hoping to play his final season out in full, Nelson decided to work on his master's degree. I really didn't think about doing something like that before all of this, said Nelson, an Iowa City native. It was probably 2.5 months of me debating whether I should come back or not. I had to deal with housing, how I'm going to pay for that extra year of school. The opportunity to play again factored about 80% into my decision. I worked hard in the off season to make this the best year that I could. For it to be taken away the way that it was, I want closure. I want to go out on my own terms. Nelson considers himself one of the lucky ones. He said he worked with his advisor and coach to find a graduate assistant program that can keep him in a Spartans uniform for one extra year. Next season will feel quite different, though. Nelson's throwing partner since his freshman year was Carlson, whose only option is to watch from the stands in 2021. That's probably the worst part about this whole thing, Nelson said. Talking with other seniors, it's been more about consoling each other. Not everybody's coming back. It's going to be a different kind of season coming into next year. Next, awaiting the call. Cascades Rhea remained in Arizona to prepare for Cubs season, by Jim Leitner. Colin Ray knows as much about the status of the 2020 Major League Baseball season as the average fan watching ESPN or following along on the internet. But the minute he receives the call from the Chicago Cubs to report to a second spring training, the 6'5", 235-pound right-handed pitcher from Cascade, Iowa, will be ready to go. And he believes he will be better positioned to make an impact for the organization than he was when the coronavirus pandemic halted the original spring training in mid-March. One week, we're super optimistic that we're going to be playing, and the next week, who knows? It's been kind of like a roller coaster the last couple of months, said Ray, who will turn 30 on July 1st. It's tough, because every year in the offseason you have a set date that you know you have to be ready for, and you're always working toward that first day of spring training. With that being up in the air, you don't know how much to ramp up and how much to throw each day. We're trying to do as much as we can without overdoing it and maintain what we had in spring training. It could be one of those things where they tell us spring training's going to start in a few days. Get there as soon as possible, so I want to be ready. At the same time, I'm just trying to keep everything in perspective because there are a lot of people dealing with more serious things than when baseball's going to start. While many Major League Baseball players returned to their homes when spring training halted, Ray opted to stay in Arizona with his wife, Megan, and their two young children. That way, he could gain access to the Cubs' training facilities in Mesa and be prepared for the restart. Players cannot use the indoor portion of the complex or the diamonds, but a handful of pitchers have been able to conduct bullpen sessions with catchers, and recently, pitchers began to work against live hitters in batting practice. Colin has been fortunate enough to stay in Arizona, where he has had an opportunity to work out with teammates every day, said Joe Speed, Ray's agent. He has kept himself in great shape and is certainly ready to go should the Cubs need him. The sessions have been anything but business as usual, though, for the handful of pitchers and coaches who have stayed in Mesa. They work in small groups, constantly use hand sanitizer or wash their hands, and some have been wearing cloth masks. Some of Ray's workouts have been solo. That means taking a bucket of balls and firing one after another into a net behind the plate, or lifting weights and conditioning at home. "We trust each other," Ray said. "We're staying in constant communication as far as where we go, and we literally go to the baseball field and go home without going anywhere else in between. It's not like we're huddled up inside around each other. We're outside. We have our space, and we're still playing catch. We're doing as much as we can as far as social distancing, but at the same time trying to get as much work done as possible." The Cubs have conducted Zoom meetings with all pitchers in the organization once each week and ask their players to log their activity on a daily basis. So, when spring training starts, the team will know who can be pushed and who will need more conditioning. For Ray, it's been productive work after a disappointing start to the original spring training. Ray won the Pacific Coast League's Pitcher of the Year award last season after registering career highs in victories, 14-4, innings pitched, 148, and strikeouts, 120, in his first season with the Cubs' AAA affiliate in Des Moines. He spent the first 8 years of his career in the San Diego Padres organization and reached the big leagues in 2015. Ray did not miss a start last season after coming back from 2016 Tommy John surgery, finished second in the PCL with a 3.95 ERA, and helped the iCubs win the PCL's American Northern Division Championship. Ray hoped to return to the big leagues out of spring training this season, but he didn't yield the results he needed in limited opportunities. The Cubs optioned him to AAA just a few days before the MLB shut down spring training. "I'd be ready if they said we're starting tomorrow," Ray said. "That's one of the big reasons we stayed down here in Arizona. I feel like I haven't skipped a beat. If anything, I've gotten better. I've had a little extra time to hang out with my family, but I've also used the time to study video on myself and other guys to see what they do. I like to watch video on guys who have been pitching for a long time, guys who have been durable, and study the way they move because, obviously, they're doing some things right." In addition to watching video of his mechanics throughout his career, Ray decided to study the work of other pitchers with similar body types and apply what he has learned to his everyday throwing sessions. "It's tough that there are no games right now," Ray said. "But at the same time, I can use this time to work on things that maybe I didn't get to work on during the offseason or things I worked on in the offseason that weren't quite where I wanted them to be. Maybe I needed to do something different because I didn't get the results I wanted in spring training. It was almost like spring training was a little bit of a test for me. Rather than the season starting and trying to work on things, now I have this downtime to either start over or change course and go about it a different way." Ray has no idea what the Major League Baseball season will look like, if it occurs at all. Some of the possibilities include an early July starting date, games without fans, a roster expanded from 25 to 28 players, and a 22-man taxi squad. Obviously, there are a lot of unknowns with the virus, the long-term effects, safety, and health, Ray said. But I know they're doing as much as they can to make us feel safe. That's the number one concern for players, coaches, and families. Personally, this is a season I can't afford to miss, with where I am age-wise and where I am in my career. The more games we play, the better for me. I'm ready to get started. I'm ready to play as soon as possible. From the world of NASCAR, Hamlin has setback in Coca-Cola 600, by Jenna Fryer of the Associated Press. Daytona 500 winner Denny Hamlin had his shot at winning another Crown Jewel event Sunday night, destroyed before the Coca-Cola 600 ever began. A piece of tungsten flew off of Hamlin's car during the pace laps at Charlotte Motor Speedway, and Hamlin had to return to pit road to have the weight put back into his Toyota. Hamlin was 8 laps down when he was finally able to join the race. The penalty for tungsten coming off a car is a 4-race suspension for the crew chief, according to NASCAR's rulebook. Hamlin, winner Wednesday night at Darlington Raceway, was clearly growing frustrated as his Joe Gibbs Racing team worked to reapply the tungsten. "Let me know when it's the point of no return and we can just go home," Hamlin said. "Nope," replied crew chief Chris Gabehart. "We can't do that." The tungsten in question weighs 35 pounds and costs $1,877 from the supplier. If it comes off a car during competition, it can cause serious damage if another vehicle hits it. The ballast is added to meet NASCAR's minimum weight requirement, and if it becomes separated from the car, it is an automatic 4-race suspension for the crew chief. NASCAR got the race started and ticked off 49 laps before rain brought out the caution. The cars were brought to pit road and covered one lap later when rain picked up and the race was red flagged. It resumed after a rain delay of nearly 80 minutes and was still going when the Telegraph Herald went to press. Kurt Busch started from the pole and was still leading when the rain began at the only event on the biggest single day of auto racing. The Sunday before Memorial Day is supposed to be a smorgasbord of motorsports that begins with Formula One at the Monaco Grand Prix, then IndyCar and the Indianapolis 500, followed by NASCAR and its longest race on the calendar. The coronavirus pandemic has wiped out the first part of Formula One's schedule, and, like IndyCar, it is still waiting to start its season. And that does it for this Memorial Day reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Monday, May 25th. I'm your reader, Ralph Skippers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. As always, thanks for listening and stay safe. Thank you.
This is Jim Ralston, and I'm with IRIS Short Take from the Iowa Curiosities. Farmers and their toys, Dyersville, Iowa. The wisdom on bumper stickers is true, and those with the most toys truly do win. Then the National Farm Toy Museum in Dyersville is a winner many times over, with two floors of more than 30,000 farm toys and exhibits, ranging from row after row of common tractors to combines, harvesters, and haulers, all the way down the extensive agricultural machinery lineup to an anhydrous ammonia tanker. The museum is a shrine and miniature to the heavy equipment Iowa farmers fuss over, endlessly fix, periodically live in during planting or harvesting, and tirelessly operate to bring home the grain or the beans that bring home the bacon. And don't let the word toy fool you. The only thing toy-like about these farm toys is that they're built to 1/16th or 1/32nd scale, and don't have internal combustion engines. This is Iowa, after all. Farm machines aren't child's play, even when they're toys. Most of the toys are stunningly accurate, not to mention beautiful. Replicas of tractors or combines with particular makers like John Deere and Case, from particular years, with details accurate down to the windshield wipers. Children play with these toys not only to have fun, they got a vocational education and heavy equipment. Highlights of the museum include an exhibit explaining the notion of scale that features a full-size replica of a John Deere tractor accompanied by a row of successfully smaller scale models, from 1/2 scale all the way down to a realistically looking tractor you can carry in your pocket. Upstairs, look for more tractors and harvesters, enclosed in glass cases, more perhaps than you've ever hoped to see. And though the word toy does technically appear in this museum's name, don't expect much playing around. Tractors, trucks, trailers, and combines, even at 1/32nd or 1/64 scale, are way too wrapped up in Iowa's blood, sweat, and sorrow to be simple objects of play. Don't be surprised if you see some old-timer kicking the tires of a tiny Case combine, wondering how it would hold up harvesting more than 2,000 acres. Or some young, unquietly cussing pocket-sized John Deere because it won't turn over. The National Farm Toy Museum is at the intersection of U.S. 20 and Iowa Highway 136 in Dyersville. Open daily from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., the museum also hosts a number of special events. Exhibits throughout the year, the largest of which is the granddaddy of all farm toy shows, held the first full weekend in November. For more information, call 563-875-2727 or visit www.nationalfarmtoymuseum.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.